did, Gary. As we've talked about, there's a lot of accounts where people are describing these families and whatnot, but yours is the first that really takes an in-depth look how they relate to one another, the individual stories that are told. It's not just the big shots, not just the major events, the things that made news, but digging a little bit deeper. You bring a lot of people on here, both on both sides of the fence, who have the firsthand experience, and you really give that frontline view that really nobody out there is doing what you're doing, Gary. Nobody's giving the front lines, having the ex guys from the life, the ex cops, ex everybody you're having on here. So you're taking a look at stories that nobody's ever looked at. You're looking at connections that nobody's ever made. It's really an interesting thing you're doing.
You are listening to Gangland Wire, hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins.
Welcome, all you wiretappers out there. Tonight we have a special guest, Camilius Robinson. Cam is a Chicago-based writer and outfit historian. He got onto my podcast, as you heard him say in that short pre-roll, he likes what I do. Now, first of all, don't forget to hit me up and buy me a cup of coffee once in a while on your Venmo app. My account name is Gangland Wire, all one word. But now, let's get on with the show. And we're going to start with the Wild Bunch. Camillus, tell me a little bit what you've learned about how did the Wild Bunch even get started. Now, the Wild Bunch was a group of younger guys back in the 70s, younger outfit guys in Chicago who, they came by their name honestly. They were wild, and not only in their personal lives a little bit, but they were dang sure wild and killing people and enforcing the rules of the Chicago outfit. So tell us a little bit about that and how it got started. We're going to focus on William Butchie Petrocelli. Now, Petrocelli, here I messed it up. There we go. I could mess up an anvil with a iron. But William Butchie Petrocelli. You know, we did a whole show. I did 4-part series on Harry Alleman. We went into Harry Alleman from one end to the other. Did you listen to that one?
I absolutely did. Absolutely did, Gary. That was a series that really, really caught me. That was excellent.
Oh, well, good. And so this was one of his early buddies, and I just kind of brushed over him, and they were part of the Wild Bunch. So Camillus, tell us a little bit about what you learned about how and why the Wild Bunch started and who was involved in the starting of it.
Well, what you've really got at the end of the 60s, you've got things in the outfit sort of in chaos. The FBI has been hitting them hard throughout the 60s. You had Giancana, who was generating a lot of attention, so he was thrown out. Then you had a series of weaker leaders and guys who were reticent, didn't really want it. You had Sam Battaglia, who wasn't a great leader. And then you had Felix Aldericio, who was not keen on the role. He was imprisoned in 69. Then it looks like Jackie Cerrone, who was a smarter guy, was going to step up. He was a Cardo's guy. But then there was an informer came along in 1970, a guy named Louis the Baker Bombacino. Now, when he came in, Jackie Cerrone ended up going away. Joe Ferriola went away. And then over the next couple of years, you've got a lot of that upper echelons of the outfit dying. You've got Milwaukee Phil dying in 71, Ross Prio, Paul Rica, and Frank Laporte dying in 72, 73, Fifi Bussieri and Sam Battaglia. So you've got a huge brain drain going on. So if I'm a guy on the street, it looks like the outfit's reeling to me. I'm going to start my own thing. I'm going to run my own book. I'm going to have my own juice loans, and the outfit seems to be a thing of the past. So around about 74, when Cerrone and Ferriola get out of prison, Turk Torello comes to Ferriola and says, "Look, we're losing the streets. We're losing control of things. We're just getting some strong leadership in here, and we got to get some guys out there who are going to crack some heads and get us the streets back. I'm not going to have bookmakers in our city who are not paying their dues. Over in Chicago Heights, they're trying to take back the chop shop rackets, and that whole war is going on. So Ferriola is not a guy who plays games. He comes out and says, I know four killers that'll take this and they'll run with it. He's got his nephew, Harry Alleman. He's got Tough Tony Borsellino, who was a former driver for Joey Iuppa. Jimmy Anandino, who was a fast riser, and Butch Petroselli, who's tight with Ailman, and they both have done quite a bit of heavy work. And he lines these guys up and says, all right, get out there, get the streets in order, and everybody who's making book is going to be kicking up to the outfit, or they're pushing up daisies, basically.
Interesting. You know, what I find fascinating about these guys is they can smell out all the gray area business, you know, like our friend Red Wimette from up there who had the porn shop and all the porn stores, the bars that are kind of like running along the edge and need a little protection there. All the people that are running along the edge, these outfit guys, of course, they're street guys. You know, they go in and out of these joints. They live that life. They probably use the massage parlors. They probably use a prostitute or two themselves. But they've got all these contacts and family members, and they have the greatest intelligence work in the world. I mean, I worked in the intelligence unit, and we had all of our people in the streets that, you know, would tell us, you know, who was doing what. And, you know, many times we wouldn't do anything about it because sometimes you just need to know, and nobody else cared anyhow, and they weren't, you know, they weren't killing anybody, and they weren't making much money. But those guys, boy, tap in that intelligence network of that Chicago outfit, that would be amazing, wouldn't it?
Absolutely. And they had that predator mindset. I don't walk around the streets looking for potential weaknesses in people. I think the average person doesn't. But whether you're an animal predator or whether you're, you know, a mobster predator, you're constantly on the prowl for prey. And it's that predator mindset where I'm looking for weakness. And like you said, they use every bit of intelligence they can get. And it's impressive, like you said. And they're going after every weakness. They're constantly looking for that next con. And it's just not a mindset that with which I'm familiar.
I would imagine these guys could sit down with you and they'd figure out, they'd watch your body language and your eyes, and they'd figure out where the hot buttons were, where they needed to push in order to get you to fall in line, in order to scare you.
Absolutely, absolutely. Masters of manipulation. And a lot of times what they would do is Ailman and Borsellino and Anandino could be a bit more light, bit more, I don't want to say friendly, but they could be easier to talk to. And they would go in, chat the new bookie up. How are we doing? How's the family? You know, from now on, you're kicking up to the outfit or else. Sometimes the guy would go along. He'd understand Chicago's an outfit city. If Petroselli had to come in, he would come in, sit down, and give him that Malocchio, that Italian evil eye, and just glare.
Yeah.
Just, you've seen the pictures of the guys. Anilo Della Croce is probably the best picture. And Petroselli was really good at that and could really intimidate people. The younger guys would come in, sort of make conversation with the bookies, and once the bookie told them where they could stick it, Petroselli would walk in and just sit across from them, just give them that dead eye that Italians call it the Malocchio, the evil eye, and he would just that glare. And you've seen so many pictures of these mobsters. They work on that from when they're young. If they're gonna be, they just stare at themselves in the camera trying to get that evil eye down. And Petroselli was good at it. You get this guy, 5'9", 5'10", 220, sitting across from you in a Italian beef shop, just glaring at you, not saying anything. You got the message pretty quickly, I think.
Yeah, like Harry Ailman, you know, they said that they said by the end he could give you that look, that he could go from being like your best friend. And I knew a few guys like this in my life. They could go from being all friendly and chummy to just click, like a switch flipped, and they just, their eyes would close down a little bit, and you knew there was death behind that. There's a couple of guys that even got convicted of extortion by, they didn't really do anything themselves, but their language was that they indicated that Harry Ailman would be the next one behind them, and so they got some money, and they ended up getting conviction, extortion for use of a weapon. Harry Ailman is a weapon. Just the name.
He's a scary guy, isn't he, Ailman, when you see those pictures of him? He's one of the creepiest guys I've ever seen.
Yeah, he is scary. He's scary. I even found a little place where he was interviewed on the news. It was kind of interesting. It was kind of cool. There's a little clip out there where he was interviewed on the news to actually hear his voice. You talk so much about these guys, but you never really hear their voice. Although I've got some wiretaps of some Kansas City guys, and I got Joey Lombardo on there, but But it's kind of cool to hear their actual voice.
Yeah.
So Petrocelli, he had a couple of contacts that he used all the time. I see from some of your notes here, this Vito Caliendo.
Vito was a porn shop owner and a bookmaker who kicked into Petrocelli, and his regular driver was a guy who owned a funeral parlor and was a gun dealer. I mean, if you can find a guy who's more suited to be working moonlighting with the mob, I mean, that was Ernie Severino. He was Butch's driver, but as a gun dealer and an undertaker in Chicago with a crematorium in Chicago, I don't know if he was looking to make friends in the outfit, but he was pretty much guaranteed to do so.
Interesting. I see it's kind of interesting that you were able to learn a little bit about their personal relationship. And Petrocelli seemed like he would be a pushy guy, and he would always want to be the big duck and the guy in charge. And I noticed in your notes that he treated this Ernie Severino like he was just some kind of a flunky and ordered him around and made him run errands and things like that. And the guy was happy to do it. It's kind of like the bully and his little buddy in high school, I got a feeling. And so that guy is constantly trying to keep the big guy happy and doing anything he can to keep him happy. Would that be a fair assessment of that relationship?
I think so, yeah. And I think that as long as if you're running that kind of service, you know you're going to get attention. And if he's already got Butch has got some pull, Butch can keep too many other guys from coming saying, hey, while you got that crematorium door open, I got another couple for you. If you're putting in an order for a couple dozen weapons, why don't you go ahead and get me a few too? So as long as he's got Butch, I'm working with Butch. You guys need to go through Butch, and that'll sort of give him that protection too. But
yeah,
he, probably like a lot of guys, he liked having a little taste of the life too.
When Butch, he worked with Harry Edelman just almost like partners, if I remember right. They hung out together in that Survival Social Club and would then work out of there for Ferriola. So that's, they went out like partners, like partners on the police department, two guys going out, as radio car partners or something like that. Would that be how they worked together?
I think so. And those two go back to when they were based on what I could find till when they were 19 or 20, really young, getting started together. When they were already running around together, getting in trouble. Butch got in some trouble early on, but there was they took over a debt from a contractor in the early 60s, a painting contractor owed about $5,000 or $6,000. They beat the hell out of the guy. They told him they were going to kill his wife, burn his house down, and really roughed him up. A couple of young guys they were at the time, and a couple of undercover officers pretended to be employees of the contractor, and they got them. That was their first big major arrest, and of course by that time it didn't make it past the grand jury, which leads me to believe they were already pretty well jumped in if they're taking over that size of debt. And they had that level of protection. I mean, undercover cops get you talking about beating somebody up, and then the case doesn't make it past grand jury. You've got some connections already.
Yeah, well, Chicago, they had that Cook County wired, man. It all came out in the end, but boy, did they have it wired. It was amazing. I'm still in awe of how they had the court system wired up up there. I had an aunt that moved to Chicago back in the 70s, and when she got her driver's license, I said, well, did you have to take the test over again, Betty? She said, oh, no, there's a guy at work that knew somebody, and that just took me to somebody, and I paid him some money. I got a new driver's license. So that would be Chicago, Cook County, wouldn't it?
That's exactly right.
Oh, I noticed you used a term in your notes, whistled in. I think I heard Frank Culotta use that term, somebody being whistled in. Interesting term. That's probably a Chicago term only, I would imagine.
Yeah, I think that's where I picked it up. You know, I'm originally from Virginia, but just in my studies, that was sort of just the term I picked up, and I did. You get whistled in, you get called in, and it seemed to apply. So I guess I picked up their term.
Well, Chicago, the outfit's a little bit different than your more solid Sicilian La Cosa Nostra families back east. You know, they would say, you know, we're gonna make you. I've never heard any or read anything where they didn't say anything, but I'm gonna make you. But Chicago, you know, Al Capone was a Neapolitan. Al Capone was not a Sicilian. And so they've always worked with a lot of non-Sicilians in Chicago and all the way up to Peckerwoods and Jewish gangsters and really worked closely with non-Frank Suisse was probably, I think he might have been part Italian, but he was, you know, a really well-connected guy up there. So Alan Dorfman, yeah, so that's... You know, they really have worked much closer and let people in. So that, and they have some different terminology. I always find that interesting, the terminology they use.
Absolutely. You know, Accardo, Joe Accardo was a Sicilian himself, but he was really dismissive of the New York guys. He'd call them paisans, but he was being an insulting way. He didn't go for any of that. The ceremonies and stuff, based on what I read, he wasn't into that. And you look at, like you said, you know, you've got higher ups, Jake Guzik in the early years, and Curly Humphreys and Gussie Alex. These are all non-Italians who are up at the upper echelons, the top levels, and it was Chicago, so it went.
Well, let's talk about some of the other older murders. You know, I did one on the Wild Bunch, but I just dealt with the 80s. So let's go back. I see that you've got these guys together probably back in 1971. And I talked about this one a little bit, what he did with Harry Alleman, this Salvatore Cesario or Sambo. That was kind of an interesting one. You know, that house where they were sitting out in front of, I found that address and I found it on Google Earth, and it's still there. It looks exactly the same as it did back then. It was kind of brownstone houses in the north side of downtown. But that was one of their first ones that we know about, October 1971. Let's talk about some of the hits that they did early on, the early 70s.
Well, there's... look at Richard Kane, who was a big guy, and that's attributed to Alleman, but it was two guys with masks, and if Alleman was doing something that early on, it was, my guess is usually it would be with his partner Petroselli. Some people dispute who it was with, but it was two masked guys, so it's, you'll find a lot of those throughout, especially throughout the 70s, two or three masked guys, one masked guy driving a car, and two masked guys jumping out and doing the shooting. So that was a lot of that I attributed to.
I'm kind of trying to remember about that Richard Kane. He was a really, I need to do a whole show on Richard Kane. He's a whole show. I'll really do some research on him. We'll get together on that. We ought to do a show on him. But there's a lot of house cleaning going on during that time. It seemed like Sam DeStefano, I think, went down shortly after that. And Giancana, and that was, they were all kind of, you know, a lot of house cleaning going on during that, after that Richard Kane thing.
Yeah, you had some real hard edge guys stepping in that time under Iuppa, and Torello, and all those guys didn't play. So if there was a problem, you're just going to wipe it out. There was no discussion. Just get rid of it. So a lot of the 70s, a lot of people think that is a big time for the mob. I think it was definitely a time when they were trying to restructure. That's, I mean, you look at the murder rates during the 70s. It's absolutely insane how many people were just getting blown in the middle of the street, just running around and blowing people away. It was insane. The I was listening to there was a thing on one of the Facebook groups my wife showed me, the Sam Anarino, who was a big guy with the chop shops, and he was there were two rival factions, but regardless, it was in I believe Oak Park. A bunch of police cars went flying by one way. Yes, it was a false robbery called in, and Anarino was in a shopping center, and van pulls up with three guys in it. It was Scalise, Borsellino, and Petroselli, I believe, jumped out in the middle of a sunny day shopping center and just blew them away with shotguns and jumped in the van and took off. I mean, this is the kind of outfit they were running, where they weren't gonna take any challenges.
Well, see, that was unheard of. There was never anything like that in Kansas City during that time. There was a couple in a bar because there was a war going on and nobody could get close to a couple guys. And they did ambush a couple of different people in bars that had innocent bystanders. But
never, you know, and the innocent bystanders were questionable whether how innocent they were in these bars where they hit these guys. But never, ever, like at a shopping mall or something like that, that's unusual. Like hitting, like Gotti hit Paul Barcelona in front of the, on the street in front of the Sharp Steakhouse. You know, those kinds of things are pretty unusual. They usually, you know, the normal way they do is get your best friend to get you somewhere alone, and then do you in majority of them. But yeah, they were the wild bunch. I see down here. Here's kind of an interesting one. In 1974, Billy Simon, who was a partner to this Sam Rannis. I didn't realize his name was Socrates. He was a counterfeiter. See, that was all.
That was that whole with the in the
that was a whole janitor in the drum story that we did, isn't it?
Correct. There was, I was trying to do some more digging into that, but there, I mean, there was a whole pack of them. One, two, three, four, five or six guys ended up dead over that whole thing. You know, Marcello and Grisafe in the drums, but then Rantis owned the shop, and his partner was Simone, and Irwin was a guy who was running around. He was killing them without authorization with Scarpelli, and they ended up killing Irwin later on. But yeah, there was a whole counterfeiting thing that they had going on, and I didn't find all the details on it. But yeah, I'm thinking that that's early. You've got a group of young hitters who are coming along, and because Scarpelli was involved with Rantis, and Scarpelli was sort of a general guy that you'd point everywhere and send him, I think that probably, if I had to guess, I would say one of these guys, the Wild Bunch, Butch or somebody, had something to do with cleaning up that whole mess and getting Simone. And I know that they got James Irwin later on, who was the guy who had started all the killing with all that. I don't know all the details of that whole counterfeiter.
Interesting. See, I wasn't sure. I interviewed the detective that worked that case, which was, folks that you have to go back and read the, I think it's called The Janitor in the Drum, two-part with James Padar, who was a Chicago homicide detective. Kind of the long story short, this Sam Rannis, he killed two, Grisafe and Marcello, and put their bodies in a drum, and then he got killed. And I think he got a couple of his buddies, this Billy Simone and another guy, to help him dispose of those, or put them in the drums. And one of them talked or something, and they killed Rannis, and then the sandwich shop stayed closed for a while. And then another guy came in to open it up and try to run it, and they were saying, well, what's that smell? Well, it sure is a bad smell in here. So they go in the storeroom, they look, and they can't find anything, and then they find a door underneath a stairwell, and there's two 50-gallon drums in there, and they pop the top on one. It's like, uh-oh. Oh, that was a funny episode. That guy talked about the intern. He said, we need somebody, our doctor, said, we need somebody to declare these guys dead. And he said, well, bring them in. He said, we had them in the drums still. He says, you don't want them in there. He said, well, what do you mean? Just bring them in. He said, no, come out here. So he popped the top on one drum, and he said, okay, they're dead. You got to love that street sense of humor, man. You got to. But yeah, there's a whole bunch of guys got killed. I would assume Grisafe and Marcello, I think that Rannis probably, he had just got out of jail or something on a counterfeiting charge, and I think he owed him money for, they were involved with the counterfeiting scheme or something. He was screwing somebody over on the money, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, I just did some preliminary on it and started noticing they were all starting to fall like dominoes, and they were all associated. And then this Irwin, who was kind of the Wild Bunch did get him later. He was the one that was, he seemed to be doing some things he wasn't supposed to. I don't know if he wasn't supposed to do those hits for Rantis or what, but he looks like the guy who took out that Marcello and Grisafe, and then he got his. Everybody got theirs after that. So this Christopher Carty is an interesting one. That's pretty well known around He was an ex-cop, a loan shark, but he was a drug dealer. He was selling heroin, and that was against the rules of the outfit. So they had him put away. They had him arrested and maxed out his sentence. He goes to jail, and he comes out of jail. He's out for 3 weeks, and the outfit blows him away on the street in front of his wife and his kid. They waited. They had him put in jail, and then they waited until he got out of jail and killed him as soon as he got out of jail. I mean, that's how you hold a grudge, man. That is.
Boy.
That's one you hear about a lot is they had the guy locked up, and then they killed him as soon as he got out. So they did not play around with unauthorized drug sales. I'll say there was some going on everywhere, but if they didn't authorize it, man, you better not do it.
There's like a whole series of people for failing to pay the street tax. I think one of the more famous one was this Anthony Reidinger, who was a bookmaker up there. They caught him in a restaurant. He suspicioned he was going to get killed, if I remember right.
I think so. I think that based on some of the things I saw, he didn't know that the outfit was that big a deal at first, and he got a warning from this. There was an undercover cop, an ex-cop who was
Ex-cop who was a bookie. I remember that now.
I can't remember his name. It was I can't remember the name. But he pointed out Reidinger to them. But he also told Reidinger, "You better not play with these guys." But by that point, I think Reidinger had mouthed off to Ailman, which didn't work out well for anybody historically. And he was in the sandwich shop, and two masked guys came in, and they unloaded into him with a 30 carbine. And then shotgun up to the side of his head and put both rounds in it, which they said then took his head off.
Seemed like with some of these murders, was there a 30 caliber carbine used in more than one? See, they were really, after the World War II, during the 50s and 60s, there was a ton of those 30 caliber carbines out here. And I think Harry Ailman was involved in several of those murders with a 30 caliber carbine. They must have had a stockpile of those things somewhere, stole them out of a warehouse or a sporting goods store or something. Dauber's was a 30 caliber. Yeah, that was an interesting one.
Good point you're making is the availability of weapons and the time period. Definitely after World War II, you had a lot of these killings with 45s because there would have been a lot of the 1911s
right.
on the street. You don't have many 9mm until much later because, you know, Smith had that Model 39, but that was a later gun. And so you had the 45 automatics and 38s because that's what you had was the Model 1911s left over from the war, and you had 38 snub noses and revolvers. So that's a good point you're making about the weapons with the after the war.
Yeah. The only thing I saw about Chicago was those kinds of guns, but they also used a .22 quite a little bit with silencer. Like Sam Giancana, they found that .22, and there were always these high standard or those semi-automatics. There was four businessmen killed by Pauly Shiro in Park Ridge, Illinois. Did a show on that, and they were all killed with a .22.
What I found was in Fratiano's book, he talks about a conversation he had with Frank Bompensero, L.A. mobster, who was a pretty big guy out there. He was tight with Spilotro when Spilotro did the Tamara Rand murder, and he said that...
Yeah, that was .22.
Chicago was able to get a lot of those .22s out of Miami, and I think that the gun that killed Giancana was originally out of Miami, so I think that... Based on that reference in that book, he says that Chicago was getting a lot of these .22s out of Miami, which would have been the Trafficante group out down there. So I believe that Chicago was able to. I believe they were buying guns, these .22s en masse through Miami, and sort of distributing to everyone around the country. Bompensero was killed with a .22 out in San Diego, and Butch was actually traced to being in San Diego. They lost him for about 8 hours. During that time, Bompensero died. Now, they've got two other guys who got Bompensero, but it sounds to me like Chicago is delivering weapons everywhere.
That might have been what it was. Interesting. It's helped set it up and delivered the guns out there to them. Then probably took them away and disposed of them. That's really, I never heard that story before. That's a good one. So, you know, let's... let's go ahead and wind this down now. We're up here a little over 30 minutes. Camillus, I want to talk about the Chop Shop Wars next time. Can you come back and talk with us about the Chop Shop Wars and these guys?
Absolutely, yeah. They did some work on the tail end, and we'll get some stuff together. And that's where your guy Scalise comes in. Is once they start lending hands with the Chop Shop Wars, they get a guy who's familiar. So that sounds.
Let's just finish up. Tell us a little bit about the demise of Butch Patricelli. He had a pretty gruesome demise. One of the more well known pictures on the internet is the death picture of Butch Patricelli. First time I saw that, I was like, oh my God, what did they do to that guy? How did he meet his end, and what caused it?
78 is when Anandino and Ailman went to late 78 is when they went to prison, and 79 is when. It's about that time, Petrocelli got a promotion. He was head of all the bookmakers. And he turns on Borsellino, says Borsellino's skimming. Borsellino says that Butch Petrocelli's lying about him. They're probably both true. Petrocelli was probably lying about him, and Borsellino was likely skimming. Just that's the nature of things. Borsellino says he's collecting extra taxes for Ailman's wife. He gets about $100,000 together, pockets the money. Ailman hears about this, tells his uncle Ferriola. The same time in Christmas of 1980, Butch throws a huge party on the Gold Coast, big lavish Christmas party, which was not well liked by his superiors. He was getting a lot of attention. He's running his mouth, talking about he's the future of the outfit. He's going to be boss someday. He's stealing all this money from Ferriola's nephew, and there was some talk about Butch is getting a little friendly with guys' wives. They called him in. They talked to him about it. He said, "Well, you know, the hell with it, I'm making money and I'm doing my thing." So then around the 30th of December is when he has to another meeting, gets whistled in to talk to him, and he disappears. It looks like he was called in to meet with La Pietra and Ferriola, and en route he was stopped by Frank Calabrese and his guys Apes Monteleone, and they put that Calabrese necktie on him. They choked him out. They slit his throat and bound him all up in a sleeping bag and dumped him in his car. It was a bright red 77 Ford LTD with that Landau roof. And Nick Calabrese went back and dumped two bottles of lighter fluid on the body, threw a book of matches in there, lit, and closed the door. Because he forgot to leave the window open, the face burned up where all the lighter fluid was on, really, really torched Butch's face really badly. And he sat in his car for about 3 months until he was found by some kids in the neighborhood who saw some shoes in the car, and they opened it up and realized it was Petrocelli. He'd been missing for about 3 months.
Well, that's quite a sight for those kids to stumble into, wasn't it? I got a friend of mine. Here's an ironic story. Maybe if ironic is the word or not. Friend of mine grew up over here in the northeast part of Kansas City, kind of Italian section, and he was about 8 or 9 years old, and he was running around with another kid who was his age named Sonny Bowen, and they found a dead body, somebody that was murdered in their car. Somebody called the police, and they go on, you know, 25, 30 years later, this guy, my friend, is a policeman now, and Sonny Bowen is now a professional criminal, and Sonny Bowen ends up getting killed in a mob hit, so... Anyhow, all right. Well, Camillus, I really appreciate you coming on, and I look forward. We'll do this again, and we'll be putting these up. Kind of have maybe a 2 or 3 week, maybe a month long, 4 week run of Chicago Outfit featuring you, and continue this going. I really appreciate you helping me out here.
Absolutely, Gary. It's a pleasure to be on, and I'm really, as I've said, a big fan, and getting to be on here talking to you and bringing what little I can to sort of contribute is I'm happy to do it. So thank you.
All right, you think along my lines. You like let's go into the nuts and bolts and the finer how they worked and who they were, the guys down underneath, not just the Gottis and the Whitey Bulgers and all that. Let's go way down in the guys that did the work, and I appreciate that.
Absolutely.
Well, wiretappers, don't forget to, I appreciate you listening to this podcast. If you have a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to call. First call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. Now, if you have iTunes, give me a review. If you like what you hear and would like to support this podcast, go to the website and the donate button or the Venmo app, and the code is Gangland Wire. Give me a cup of coffee. You know, I produced a documentary, Gangland Wire, and written a companion book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. You can get those at Amazon. You can rent my movie on Amazon, or you can buy those off my website. And finally, don't forget about the Kansas City Mob Tour app and the Apple App Store. Good night, all you wiretappers out there. Good night, Camellias.
Night, Gary.
Music provided by our good friend and super fan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.